Welcome to the wundersame Fahrradwelt, your cycling podcast about fixed gear, gravel and ultracycling. Hosted and produced by the one and only Johanna Jahnke.
Yeah, party time, moin from Hamburg. It's the 50th episode and yeah, it's a little bit unbelievable. 50 seems a lot, but not that much on the other hand, so yeah, but it's a round birthday, so yeah, you can celebrate it with me and enjoy this episode, maybe with a piece of cake or something, I don't know. Yeah, so it's crazy, 50 episodes and a lot of work in any single episode, I can tell you that, but I think most of you know it because sometimes I get messages, please Johanna, never stop this podcast, and I'm like, why do people think I would stop doing it? But yeah, I guess I think you know how much passion and work this is, and if something is really close to your heart and you really want to make it properly, and then if you can't anymore, maybe you stop doing it, but I won't. Let me tell you this, I won't stop this podcast for a while at least. Yeah, but anyway, I hope you are all well. In Germany, there's a lot of new freedom on bikes. You can ride with up to 30 people now. It's been amazing to ride in groups again. It's like once you do it again, you realize how much fun you missed out on during the last year, I guess. So get vaccinated if you can. It's a bit difficult right now, but try to get a vaccination. I have my first and I think I get my second in a couple of weeks. And yeah, it feels good to feel safer soon. Anyway, my amazing guest today is Lian van Leeuwen, founder of Shift Cycling Culture. Lian is a cyclist, a cycling photographer based in Rotterdam. Lian photographed and blogged at the Retrocrit, the Transcontinental Race, the Atlas Mountain Race, the Silk Road Mountain Race, and will be covering the inaugural Migration Gravel Race. Most of these races and events have been discussed in this podcast, so I'm very happy that we can add yet another perspective through Lian's lens, literally. I ask her how the cycling culture can be shifted. We talk about the Team Armani initiative that is aimed at trying to move the dial on inclusivity in the sport by creating race opportunities for East African riders. And of course, Lian explains why she founded Shift Cycling Culture and shares a new project, the Cracked Earth Film, with us. It's been a really great conversation with Lian. I absolutely enjoyed it. Sustainability has been a topic in this podcast since it started, and I'm always happy to learn more and widen my knowledge about this topic and see something or someone doing great things in this area and helping the cycling industry to develop to a more sustainable industry. And before we start with the interview, I'll introduce you to the sponsor of today's episode. This episode is supported by my longtime supporter Komoot. And Komoot wants me to make you aware of the Dead Ends and Cake Challenge. You may remember that we talked about the Dead Ends and Cake race, which will be taking part in the end of June, so in a few weeks. But since the race was sold out in seconds, basically, the organizer, Dominic, decided to create a challenge as well. The challenge will start on July the 1st and goes until September the 30th. The Dead Ends and Cake Challenge gives you the chance to create your own adventure. What you have to do? You create basically your own adventure and you visit at least two of the checkpoints from Dead Ends and Cake. Then you upload your ride to Komoot. You follow Dead Ends and Cake on Komoot and add them to your ride. And then you tell your story on social media under the hashtag DeadEndsChallenge. By the end of September, winners of the following categories will be awarded: Best Story and Pictures, Most Vertical Meters, Most Likes on Komoot, Fastest Time, Start and Finish in St. Gallen, and all 5 checkpoints. If you want to know more, look at the Dead Ends and Cake homepage. I will link it in the description of this podcast, of course. And yeah, I will be there too. So maybe we'll see each other on the road. The second supporter of today's episode is Athletic Greens. I've been testing Athletic Greens for over 3 months now, and it's been really good for me. It simply helps me to ensure a basic supply of vitamins and minerals. I've already mentioned a few times in the podcast that I had to coordinate quite a lot here at home when my kids were homeschooling. They are back at school now. But before that, it was work, homeschooling, training. Yeah, and taking care of my own health has been a bit neglected, which I was actually always quite good at. When Athletic Greens asked me to be a tester, I didn't hesitate for long. And yeah, I feel great. The energy came back. You get all your daily nutritional needs in one spoonful. Athletic Greens contains 75 vitamins, minerals, a superfood complex, prebiotics, and adaptogens, as well as other proven effective ingredients. Athletic Greens is constantly evolving. Currently, the 52nd version is on the market. Sounds interesting? As a listener to my podcast, you will receive an exclusive offer at athleticgreens.com/Fahrradwelt. Athletic Greens also offers you a 60-day money-back guarantee, so you basically have nothing to lose. Right now, there is a promotion exclusively for listeners of my podcast. At athleticgreens.com/Fahrradwelt, you get 10 travel packs free to go with your Athletic Greens subscription. So head on to athleticgreens/Fahrradwelt to check it out. Lian van Leeuwen, welcome to the podcast. I'm extremely happy you found the time for this interview. How are you, Lian?
I'm doing good and I'm really looking forward to it. So happy to be here.
How was your overnighter? Did you actually manage to do it?
My overnighter? Oh, no, sorry. I mentioned that to you, yeah. No, I didn't do it because it was too busy and I kind of just canceled last minute, sort of. But it's a friend I can do that with. But yeah, there was too much going on that I needed to attend to. So we'll do that soon again because we finally can get out a little bit more again. And that's one of the fun things to do, right? Just get out for one night and do like the micro-adventure thing to kind of break up your week. And yeah, so but this time no. But soon, yes, I hope we can do it soon again. Yeah,
when you told me about it, I was like, oh, she's so smart, I should do the same. Just, you know, we're sitting here on a Friday and just to, yeah, end the week in the outdoors.
That's the thing. It's like I said, and that was, it was a bit of a, I kind of, if it's really busy like it is now, then it kind of even becomes too much of a, even thinking about, oh, I need to pack and then I need to go and I need to be back by, you know, and then it's becoming a bit of a burden. But it's, I love that you don't feel you're losing any sort of time with your family or time with your work, or, and you're still having an adventure. So it's a really lovely way to go out, I feel. And it's, even if you only do like a short ride, you feel like you had an adventure. It's lovely.
Yeah, yeah. So how is it in the Netherlands? You're based in Rotterdam.
Yes.
And so where would you go there for an overnighter?
Yeah, it's we're not the best country to get out into nature. Although we do have beautiful pockets, and if it's an overnighter, it can be different things. It can be like nearer to the beach, which is lovely that we do have like a huge coastal line and dunes, etc. But in this case, we were planning to spend the night on a bit of a campsite that is also catering a little bit to cyclists. So, and they have this place where you can make a campfire, and it's, it's almost glamping actually. So that was like a really easy one out. And I mean, there, like I said, there are beautiful pockets in the Netherlands, but it's just the most of them are in the east of the country or south, a bit further away. So for an overnighter, that's too far away for just a quickie. But if it's a bit longer, I really love to go east or south from Rotterdam. Yeah.
And why is it so difficult in the Netherlands? Is it because it's so crowded with people? A nice way to put it, but I mean,
yeah, it is. It's exactly that. I used to travel, and when I came into countries like Australia, which is of course a huge one, but also South America, etc., and you try to explain to people how small the Netherlands is. I just said it's like a mid-sized farm in your country, but then with 16 million people, and I think it's now 17 million maybe even. So I mean, it is crowded, but there's just really, well, too many people to be honest. And that also means that nature is like, there is not real nature. I mean, we have some beautiful, we have actually 21 national parks, which is quite a lot for a small country, I feel. But they're all tiny. So even if you get out, you really need to build your route. And then you can have like a lovely, lovely long ride. We did this overnighter at one point. A friend of mine made that route, and that was like 320 kilometers during the night. And he just made all these little trails, like build all these little trails together into one big route. And we didn't see, you know, hardly saw any tarmac or hardly saw any villages or etc. for the whole route. So you can do it, but it's just, yeah, it's tough because it just ends like after a couple of kilometers of beautiful stuff, because we do have a very varied landscape. It's just, you know, you're back in cities or villages or anything man-made basically.
Yeah, so a wonderful country for cycling in general, but maybe not for like getting lost.
Yeah, exactly that. But I mean, I have to say the lovely thing though is that we can ride to Germany in one day, we can ride to Belgium in one day, we can, you know, even do three countries in one day. So stuff like that is of course special as well. So yeah, it's the way you look at it, but sometimes I feel I wish we had some more of like real nature areas to get lost in, like you say. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, I'm living in the middle of Hamburg, so
totally a bit the same. Yeah, true.
I even thought about taking the train maybe outside of Hamburg and then going for a ride. But then on the other side, I like starting from my doorstep, and I feel it's a little bit, I don't know, it's not cheating, it doesn't really matter, but it's not the same to hop on a train first. But yeah,
it's true, although it is a way to, you know, go to other places, and I usually do it the other way around and just cycle first and then take the train back. But right now in during COVID, that wasn't, you know, it wasn't really possible, and doesn't feel too good to be just, you know, leisurely traveling that way. So didn't do that, but it is a good way to kind of make that circle a bit bigger, specifically if you only have like one day or not unlimited times. So it works.
Yeah. So how is the COVID situation in the Netherlands right now?
We're actually opening up a little again, because we our second lockdown has been quite a long one, and like lockdown is more semi-lockdown, because you were still allowed to go outside, and I have a son, he was able to go to school in primary school since since somewhere March, I feel. I'm not sure, April. But anyway, but it was quite a long one, and restaurants were closed, bars were closed, shops were mostly closed. And that's kind of opening up now. So we're even, it looks like we will be allowed to eat indoors in restaurants for a couple of hours from Monday on or something next week. So it looks a little bit up again, which is good. Yeah.
Yeah, sounds really good. Germany is opening up again too. But I think so far eating outdoors, riding in groups is allowed again, which is cool because you can do group rides with up to 10 people. And nice. I miss that a little bit.
Yeah. This is the tough part, right? Just not socializing really. And yeah. And I mean, I think the same goes for you guys, but it wasn't the best spring ever so far. So that was like, we were allowed to go out and eat on the terrace of a restaurant for like up till 6 a.m. or something, but it was, or so p.m., but it was so cold and windy everywhere. And then we did it a couple of times, but it's not like just relaxing in the park or on a terrace or you know, bike rides. I wasn't cycling that much, to be honest, but it's like bike rides, doing them and not being able to have like a break in between just to eat something properly. And then being in the cold, you can't really stop, as you know, and then you just, you know, it's just pushing on. And it's fine, but it's like, yeah, it would be so nice to have that stuff again and just being able to sit in the sun. But it's looking out now, so I'm not complaining.
Yeah, same here.
Looks good.
So,
yeah.
So there's the prospect of better weather.
Yes.
Is there.
So good. Yeah. Sun mostly, right? Temperature is fine, but like sun coming out makes all the difference.
It does, really. Yeah. Just seeing the sun. I mean, I can wear like long. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, but no.
If I see the sun, it's really cool. Yeah. Leanne, your website states that you are a frequent cyclist. We already we can confirm that. A cycling photographer, a strong her ambassador, based in Rotterdam, and wandering with gusto. I'm sure we'll talk about all these things during this interview. For me and for the listeners, is of its special interest that you photographed the Red Hook Crit, the Transcontinental Race, the Atlas Mountain Race, the Silk Road Mountain Race, the race around Rwanda, and the migration race.
I have to jump in there because I didn't photograph the Silk Road Mountain Race. I was involved for blogs and also in the first year, actually almost all of the coverage from just outside of Silk Road, because you know it was really hard to even connect to the photographers and organizations on the road because it's so remote. So I didn't shoot that. I was involved in the rest, and the race around Rwanda. I haven't been there, and I haven't been connected to that. So that was also not me. But the rest, yes, definitely, yeah.
Okay, why did I have that on my list?
Yeah, Silk Road makes sense because I was involved very closely.
Yeah,
but just not as a photographer. So
I know why, because I connect the race around Rwanda very much to the migration race.
Yeah,
and
I
that
can
hasn't. Yeah, yeah, that's why.
Yeah.
We have to talk about this in
definitely
more detail, because this hasn't been discussed on the podcast before too. So we've just, Nils Lenger was here, who's also a photographer, and I'm sure you know him and you met.
Yes, we spent time together in Morocco. Yeah,
yeah, and he told us about his plans to attend the race around Rwanda, but I haven't actually talked to him or anyone about it afterwards. And it wasn't a race, it was a tour around Rwanda in the end due to COVID.
Yeah.
And the migration gravel race hasn't taken place yet either.
It will. It's planned for a couple of weeks from now, actually.
22nd, 23rd of June.
I went there on the recce in October last year.
On the recce?
Yes, the recce of the race, which is like the reckon of the whole route, and went with the organization as a small team and a couple of riders from East Africa that will participate in the race as well. And just to really follow the, you know, it's really important, and I know that Nelson from Atlas and Silk Road also thinks that way. It's super important for an organizer to really have ridden the route and make sure that you really know what you're, or just scouted the route fully, know what you're, where you're putting people into, basically. And just also the logistics and of this race, particularly the migration gravel race, is pretty special. It's a different kind of race, so to really figure out how that all could work, and to really also of course get some pictures in, because it will really spark the imagination of people, and that's super important if you set up a race and just kind of want to show what it will be like, So we did the whole thing. I didn't do it on bike, of course, because I was shooting, but did the whole thing in October with a couple of riders, from local riders, and one guy from the Netherlands. Then he now just moved, but who is the initiator of the whole project.
All right. And what makes a race like this different from other like races we know? Like the transcontinental. Oh no, the transcontinental is a completely different type of race. But
yeah, but I know what you mean. Yeah. It actually has different reasons. The one reason, for just the very practical sense, is that I think the races that you know and the scene that we know, is they are very much about endurance, ultra endurance. You just get on your bike and you only get off when you finish, and then sometimes you sleep in between if you're lucky. This race will be a four-day race that doesn't allow riding through the night, just simply because it's too dangerous. Because you have, it goes right through to Masai Mara in Kenya. You got the wild animals there, and during the day that's fine. But during the night, it's just too dangerous to be on your bike by yourself next to lions and elephants. So it's just really, in a practical sense, they couldn't make it an ultra-endurance race. And the funny thing is that during the recce, it was a lot of like discussed, like, what kind of race is this? Is this like, it's going to be a stage race for sure, because we can't do anything else about it. But what makes this kind of race? And what will be super interesting to see is that it's going to be a stage race that is super hard. It's all off-road, and it's a lot of climbing, and it's already really high altitude. So it's rough for sure, and definitely if it starts to rain or the wind can play up as well. But what is special is that you can likely push your limits physically a bit more during the day, because at the end of the day you will end up in a camp where there is food and there is a tent, and you don't have to all arrange that yourself. During the day you're on your own, but like when you arrive at night, there is like a campsite in the middle of nowhere, beautiful settings, very basic, but also very comforting, of course, compared to, you know, a lot of the races like Atlas Mountain Race, where people just really have to find their own food, their own place to stay. And specifically if you're racing, not if you're doing it a little bit slower, but if you're really racing, then it's super, super tough. And in this sense, this will be also more of there will be more time to socialize if people, I mean, I've seen the recce and I know that people were really, really, really tired at the end of the day and done for, but still there is a sense of, you know, you can gather around the campfire, you have to eat your food with everyone that is participating in this race, and it's pretty small group of people, because also logistically and because it's the first year, they wanted to keep it like manageable. So it will be very interesting to see how that works out, because I haven't really been on a race like that as a photographer, where the social aspect and like I said, the pushing of the stages is a bit more. We have two ex-pros actually coming in that will ride it as well, and it's probably a little bit more catered for those kind of riders, because they are used to really pushing it and then at the end of the day finishing. And mentally, that's of course also like a different thing. You finish at the end of the day, and you can just, I've seen how hard it is. It's not an easy race, but it will be a different race for that reason. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So how long are the individual stages?
It depends. It's the longest one is 160, I think. And then altitude is pretty full on as well. But the thing is that you have to, of course, be in the camp before sunset, and that means that if you're like halfway through the day and there's this checkpoint that you don't make in time, you're just diverted to another shortcut route and you're officially out of the race. So that will also be interesting to see, because if you have a mechanical that you can't really fix fast, and that might be the reason that you're out of the race while you otherwise could have fixed it and jumped back on. So yeah, that's all kind of stuff that will have to figure itself out. But there are tough days, mostly because of the climbing and the surfaces. It's, yeah, definitely. I've seen it all, and the surfaces, they are, some are really hard packed gravel roads, and you can really chase. But other stuff is just hike a bike, and you know, especially when it's raining, there's this thing called black cotton. And I think, you know, I come from the Netherlands. I thought I knew mud, but this is like a whole other category. And it's, if it will rain, it will, wow, I don't know what will happen. This is going to be crazy for sure. Because it did during the recce at one point, and just, you know, it just sticks to everything and you can't get it off, really. It's
okay.
Crazy.
Yeah.
But, and then I have to say the other reason for it to be a different race is that this race is actually not just a race. It's very much part of a whole project. And the race is just one of the ways to kind of reach the objectives. And this race is part of Team Amani and the Amani Project. And that is an initiative that was started 2 years ago by Michael de la Grange, an American bike owner, but also attorney at the criminal court in The Hague. And he was, for his work, was traveling a lot to East Africa, was also a cyclist and like I said, a bike shop owner, and really just got into touch with different groups and professional cyclists in the countries of Rwanda, Uganda, and Kenya. And talking to them, it turned out that he said he just started asking questions. So what is your need, or what would you want to be supported with? And basically everything that he got back the whole time was, we just would like to have opportunities to race. So with that thought, he just started this project called Project Amani, to try and create more opportunities for East African cyclists. And that's very much in collaboration with local forces, which is super important, I think. And that makes this race like a very special thing, because for one, you bring a race to East Africa instead of having East African riders travel all over the world to kind of, you know, try and build a career. It's in this case, like, of course, the emerging or already sort of set gravel scene is becoming bigger and also getting more interest from the professional cycling world, which means that there will be like a larger podium for them to show their strength. And other parts of the project are to bring young, potentially strong riders to Europe to kind of already kind of get to know the still pretty conventional way of pro cycling in Europe, etc. And then they also have built an e racing platform, so they can compete on a virtual level, basically. So all these things are really part of that project, and the race is just one of the prongs of the project, and that's what I really love, because it's also like one third is even going to be more. Like one third of the racers or riders will be from East African countries, and there's some really strong contenders in there. So it's going to be super interesting to see how that field will play out against people like Ian Boswell, who's going to join, and Laurence Sandam, and people that kind of moved into gravel cycling but come from the pro cycling scene. And some other very, very strong riders, just from the gravel scene as we know it. So it's going to be a cool one to see. Yeah.
So the aim is to get them into pro cycling?
Not per se, but get them into, that could be a direction, but for instance, there is one of the people within the organization is Sula Kangangi, and he is now he was at Pro Continental Team for several years. He's still connected to them, but is not riding for them right now, because he is also kind of moving into the gravel racing. And that is sort of course, kind of becoming this whole new subgenre, basically also of pro cycling. So in that sense, yes, it is directed to a higher level of cycling, but the other side of it is that we've seen that already happening, because we also were organizing kind of a series leading up to the main event, a local series, that you kind of create this grassroots gravel scene in countries where, specifically Kenya, where the race is being held, is a runner's country. So you have a lot of aspiring youth wanting to become runners or just doing that as a sport. For cycling, that's not developed in that way. So it's going to be super cool to see how this will also kind of help build a cycling community in these countries that isn't, you know, it isn't happening right now. It starts to happen right now. But it's really, so it's both, I mean, the project started with really with pro cycling, but it's both kind of grassroots coming up as more top down as, you know, getting pro cyclists and giving them more, opening up the pro cycling world a bit more to a continent that's not represented really. So it's those both sides really for the project that get the attention.
Yeah, sounds really cool. I wonder, you talked about running, and I mean, it's pretty easy to start running, I guess, because all you need is shoes, I guess. So, but for gravel cycling, you need a gravel bike and you need all the equipment. So how is that solved? I imagine it's difficult in these countries.
Yes and no, because running, funny is running is so big, specifically in Kenya, because you have some really prominent, heroes on the world podium that come from Kenya mostly, actually. So it's like they have the examples, and Sula, who is involved in the project, is one of the few cycling examples that really inspires youth. I do agree that you need more stuff for cycling than you need for running. But that said, there is somewhat of a cycling culture in Kenya. And like I said, the other countries I know a little bit less of. So the focus is on Kenya for this. But what you see is that they have, for instance, they have races with what they call Black Mambas. And Black Mambas are just basic, very simple urban bikes that are very, you know, popular in rural areas as transport, and these races have been going on for I don't know, a decade or something. So I mean, it does exist in that sense. And then as you know, basically, and it's what I sort of recently organized with Shift as well, you don't need all the best stuff to enjoy a bike ride, or you don't need like the perfect gravel bike to ride bikes. But if you really want to compete, of course, it's a different thing. But what we saw as well with the recce, two of the people that were on this, lovely lady called Kate and a friend of hers, and they
I'll
were
link
on these.
I will link her in the show notes. I follow her on Instagram. Cool. She's
really
cool.
She's lovely. Yeah, but then the thing is, they rode this whole thing on basically old steel mountain bikes that were converted by a local mechanic to more of a gravel setup, and it's doable. You know, it's not like it's tougher. I mean, I credit her for it because I felt the bike and it's damn heavy. With all the climbing in there, but it's like, it's just, to sort of get into it, you don't need that much. So it's more that I think it's kind of the creating of heroes, so to speak. What's been said many times over the last year for other reasons, but if you don't see it, you can't be it, is very much, the case here. So it's like, if you don't have any real cycling culture, as in, people kind of inspiring you as a hero, it's not something that you really think of doing. So it will be super interesting to see if that kind of changes. And then there's also very much an emerging, because that's also good to mention, there's a very much an emerging mid-class group of Kenyans that are more than capable to buy a gravel bike if it's available, because it didn't really enter the country yet as a thing. But I mean, that could be a mountain bike as well, of course, or just a road bike that you kind of convert. And it's just more that it just wasn't really present as a sport, basically. Not in that way as it is in Europe or in the States or something. So yeah.
And I read somewhere in the interviews, I think the interview where you also talked with Michael Delagrange. I don't know. Yeah, you mentioned.
I always struggle with that one as well. I just keep it to Michael, but
yeah. Who is the organizer and who's basically behind the initiative, yeah. And he said that there is already the Tour de Rwanda, a road bike race, and it's very financially, it's very unstable. Anything can happen anytime. So he's also aiming at making it more stable.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, that's not. Yeah, that could be like it's that was about that race, but also definitely in general for cycling on a pro level, where you have teams that you know with professional cyclists that cycle all day, and that's what they do. That is unstable in any country basically, because it's not just a very. We see that now after COVID. You know, it's a couple of teams really. Hardly made it in the pro scene even then, and he says in East Africa that's definitely even more so the case. They kind of, if they find funding, for instance, that's usually just for a race, not even for a season. So what he's trying to do is build some more sustainability financially for those kind of riders in these countries, where they can really focus on their career and not have to worry about how they can, you know, manage next month with their income. So that's definitely also part of it. Yeah. Yeah. And that's also why this race, for instance, if this will be something that is gaining more, more attention and more riders will join it in coming years. And you got spin-offs of different things in local scene, etc. It could be one of the ways to kind of build that more structural, finance system or at least a part of it, because that's not going to be sufficient likely in itself, because it's not like a commercial viable thing to organize races, we probably all know, but it's like it could help build that more, that structure around it a bit more.
When I've been thinking about these races far away in undeveloped areas, and there's always the goal to build income opportunities for the locals. And I think it's a really honorable goal, kind of. There is criticism with it as well. I mean, it's still someone from the outside going there. And
yeah, totally agree. But that's why I got so, how do you say that? So inspired by the project, because Michael as an organizer has seen so much of that, oh, we as Westerners will come into this country and show you how it's done kind of thing, and he's really allergic to that for that reason, and this race and this project is done really in collaboration with local forces, so you have local riders, you have local team members, you have local the race, for instance, goes through the Masai Mara. The logistics guy who is organizing the whole, the camps and the catering and everything, he works in close collaboration with even the Masai local. It's a full local team, of course, but it's also in collaboration with the Masai, who will help with anything from building camps or getting water in or security, or, and he's been doing that for so long that his connections are really close. And when we were doing the recce, we were accompanied by one of the local chiefs there, who was just, you know, helping us with informing the local Maasai that the race was coming through there. Area, and they were helping us with kind of being the sweeping car or motorbike, basically being the sweeping motorbike of the race, and being sort of security in the camps, and security, I mean, for wild animals, just to on the lookout, because it's not that dangerous, but it's like stuff like that. And that's what I really think is the good way of doing things. It's like Michael always says, I don't want to be telling anyone what to do. I just ask questions and say, how can we accommodate that or facilitate that with like a very developed cycling structure, basically in the Netherlands or also in the rest of Europe. But he was based in the Netherlands for a long time. So he said it's way more how can we, because we have a more developed system, can be of service and facilitate this to kind of step up there as well. And that's why I really applaud this project, and I'm happy to be part of it, because it's not just coming in and saying, okay, can we, you know, bring in some people from outside and just do this race here, and you know, it's very much focused on what it will accomplish locally. And the fact that you have others coming in to also race is great, because it's like a good field of strong riders that you want to build up. And it's also an experience, and it's also showing that specifically, I mean, the image that people have of Africa is a continent. It's like if you would say like Europe was a country, it's so diverse, and I've only you know, scratched the surface of it, but with a few visits in different countries. But it's just a very developed country or area as well in some cases. So it's like it's really good to kind of show different sides, I feel, to that kind of far away area for people. Yeah.
And I personally am just making exactly this experience, that I'm through these races getting interested in the countries and in the complexity of the small countries within the whole continent, Africa. And so where can we follow the race? Can you give us some advice?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Instagram is Migration Gravel Race. And the website is migrationgravelrace.com. So I think everything is you can find through there, basically. It's going to be worth it. It all looks good still. I mean, it's COVID time, so we never know, but it still looks really good, and it's just going to happen. And it will be exciting to see how this develops. Yeah.
Will you be there? As a
I will be there. Yeah, I'm cool. Shooting it. Yeah. I'm photographing it.
And so, do you know of any of the ultra cycling scene? Any participants?
Yeah, Josh Ibbett is doing it. Semi is doing it. Semi Sauri.
Cool. Yeah, she's cool. My friend.
yeah, I know. Yeah, so that's I mentioned it. But so I think of there are a few more, but like the main that come to mind is that people will know likely that listen to this is them. And then, like I said, Lawrence and Dam just also did further last year, of course. And he will be attending as well. And Ian Boswell, who's been doing more gravel, but that less these kind of things. So for him, that's going to be, I wonder how that is going to pan out, but it's going to be interesting to see. And then, like I said, some really strong riders, like someone that, you know, it's like really strong riders from the local area that are a bit more in some pro cycling, road cycling, and some were more in mountain biking. And that's going to be, I'm really looking forward to see how that kind of compares and how everyone will experience this race. So it's going to be, I think it's going to be an interesting one to follow. Yeah, for sure.
Cool. Yeah. But it's not going to be on Dot Watchers or?
Yeah, it will be on Dot Watcher. Ah, yeah, cool. Yeah. It will be Dot Watcher. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. And do you think, because we've had this here, we've discussed bike types in this podcast before, and sometimes the mountain bike is more appropriate for a gravel race. What do you think for this race?
Sorry, if I said it will be on Dot Watch. It will be, you can dot watch it. It's,
okay. Yeah, I didn't. But not on Dot Watch.
No, no, yeah. I just realized it's not, that's probably not you, but it might be, yeah. It might be a good one. But anyway, yeah, for the bike, this is definitely a gravel bike track, I feel, because there will be times when you curse your your gravel bike. But there is enough hard packed stuff in there that will really give you speed. I think a mountain bike will slow you down looking at it, but I mean, like I said, I haven't cycled it. I've seen the cyclists and I can kind of compare stuff, of course, with Atlas Mountain Race and some other races that you follow closely. And so this is definitely like a gravel bike kind of race, but I mean, that doesn't mean like every time you can't do it on a mountain bike for sure. And you know, can you do it on a road bike? That might be pushing it, but anything is possible, of course. But yeah, no, anything above decent tire width is doable. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess this is the main thing, the tire width.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah.
40 centimeters plus.
Yeah, but it's not going to be, I've seen it close up, of course, and it's not Atlas Mountain Race, because that was, for a lot of people, that was like a, like a real, you know, I really applaud for the people who finished it on their gravel bike, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
That's true. Sofiane did, I mean, and he...
Yeah, and he was, yeah, and more won. People did. Jenny yeah. did, actually.
Yeah,
and,
true, and Jenny did too.
Yeah, and
crazy.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Whoever did it, yeah. Some more did it, but it's just, it was, I really thought it was, an extra, I think they should deserve something extra for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Since... this year's Transcontinental Race just got postponed to next year, yeah. And I think it's a very sensible decision. Many people are quite sad about it,
yeah.
But yeah, I think that's if you cross a continent and have to take ferries and cross several borders, and yeah, it's not a race anymore, even if you make it in a safe way. Anyway, so the decision has been made and you have been photographing the Transcontinental Race too. I know that you were there 2017. Was that your first ultra race that you photographed?
Yes and no, because I was there the year before that at the start of the Transcontinental Race. And that's just because I reached out with... not many people know that, but in the back of my mind that I might want to do it one day, and then figured I might as well volunteer, because it was easier to get in if you did, and also because I was super interested. So I kind of, and I'm in the Netherlands and the start is in Belgium, so I was like, I can just, you know, volunteer, and I'm just interested in it. It just really interests me. So I didn't do anything that kind of similar stuff, but I did a gravel race gravel trip, basically a 3-day thing that was way before its time, looking back, but in Sweden, Dalslandrund. So I really got interested in kind of being on the bike for longer days and what that does with you mentally, etc. So I kind of reached out just to volunteer, and Mike, which turned out to be his last year, was there. Where they came back, and I just mentioned that I also shot some photos sometimes, did Red Hook Crit by then, I think. And then they were like, yeah, please come over, and if you could shoot the start, that would be amazing. So I kind of went there, made it a bike trip, because it was like a 220 kilometer thing. So just stayed overnight and then went there to shoot, and met everyone, and kind of really... love the vibe of it. And then the next year they asked me, Mike and Anna asked me to come and shoot one of the checkpoints initially, and that got changed into shooting the finish line, which was super interesting. So it was in that sense a second one, I guess, but the first one that I fully did.
I was wondering about this, and You already mentioned it, that you were interested in what ultra cycling does to you. And I think it's important to point out that you not only shoot races, that you also write blogs about your experiences or what you find interesting, I guess. So, and I found a really cool quote. This is your blog, In Transit.
And yeah, I wrote about the finish line of the Transcontinental when I was there. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was there the year after in Meteora, and it was really, I could relate to many of the things you wrote, because before I read this out, many people think the race is over when it finishes, but that's not really true. Many things happen once you're over the finish line, and it can be good to maybe know kind of what's happening. And I will link your blog in the show notes because it's really cool. I just read out the quote before I stumble with my cool English. Because you found really cool words. This is the quote. Life reduced to an infinite pressing of the refresh button. But maybe that is the real genius of this race. Time is taxing on all of us. It never seems to travel at the right speed. We waste it. It consumes us. It distances us from what we used to love or dreamed we would become. The transcontinental race allows us a vacuum, both in time and space, both for riders and followers. Yeah, and then the vacuum is over, and your work started in 2017, and you just watched the people and those who waited for their loved ones who raced, sometimes for weeks, I guess, sometimes for days. And maybe you can give us an example of what happened, or give us some of your thoughts.
Yeah, definitely. It was super interesting because I could really relate to both sides of it. And what I try to do with a blog was basically also just, and that's why I write most of the time, to kind of make sense of stuff. And that's, I guess that's what I try to do in everything I do. Just, I want to make sense of stuff. And what was amazing to see, and in this case, it was, it started with James Mark Hayden's mom, who was there at the finish line, I spent 2 weeks there because, you know, the first one coming in and then the last one going out until the finishes party. So it was, I saw people coming in, which is amazing because you see so different, many different ways of coming in and experiencing this race. And I saw her sitting, and I've made a picture of that. It's not actually not, I think it's not at the blog, but it really says a lot to me. She was just sitting there and refreshing and refreshing and refreshing her iPad to see where her son was at for the final stage. And that in itself is really, and I know that from a lot of followers, is just, you know, your life, and that's what I say in the blog, it kind of comes to a halt as well if you're like a loved one of someone that is doing that race, because everything is consumed by that dot on the screen, basically, for 2 weeks or for whatever long it takes. And that was so visible. And what I found most interesting, actually, was because I traveled a lot by myself and I was away for longer times, and I did some hardcore stuff, which is really tied to fun that you really get, you know, really mentally challenges you. That arriving from the one side of the riders, I really got the arriving is not the arriving, because you're not there yet. You haven't finished. You might have finished, but you haven't, you know, you haven't really been able to process everything. You haven't really, you've been by yourself for a long time, and usually, or sometimes it's just duos, but even then you're in your head a lot of the times. And then you, all of a sudden you come into this world where people expect things of you and kind of want you to be present and you're not yet. So I kind of really related to that. But I also related to the other side, seeing, for instance, James's mom, but also Nelson's girlfriend at the time, who was Nelson was also writing it, kind of really looking out to that moment that their loved one arrives, and then they're like, okay, they're here. And they didn't, that they haven't arrived yet, because they aren't there mentally yet. So that was super, I think processes like that are interesting, but it's also interesting because it says a lot about, and I haven't even written one, so I can't really say, but I, like I said, I did similar things that really get you into mind state of and did Long Rise and didn't I Rise and did Hard as Rides. But it really gets you in this state of mind that is something special. And I think that's why people want to do stuff like this. But it's also, it takes time to kind of recover from that. And that whole dynamics was, I thought that was super interesting. So that's kind of stuff that I just, you know, witnessed, and I was lucky enough to witness and capture people coming in different kind of vibes and also with sometimes family and friends waiting and sometimes not. And just, you know, yeah, it was just so super interesting as a situation and dynamics, like I said, to witness. Yeah.
And those who, let me say, those who hadn't obviously arrived yet, how did they like get along?
Yeah, it's funny because I was an objective viewer, so I'm lucky in that sense, I guess. But you just see them. Some, I have this picture of an this fringe guy. I don't know his name. Yeah, he did really do well. He was top 10. I'm probably top 5 even. I'm not sure, but he couldn't say anything for. Like, you know, people just jump in and say, oh, you're great, you did so well. And, you know, that was a cool thing about a place like that. You, other riders that already finished kind of wait for you and kind of cheer you in. And, but he was just, after, you know, 1-2 minutes, I would just leave this kid alone. He needs some time, you know, to kind of process the fact that he finished this monster, basically. And then others were just, they just came in as if they did a, I don't know, around the block, basically. And just, you know, very, very cheerful and very happy and just, you know, very, very open to other people. So it's just interesting because it says a lot about, I think it says a lot about your experience that you had, but also as a person, if, you know, what kind of person you are and what you, you've been thrown back on yourself. So it kind of is also the raw you kind of arriving, I guess. And then there was the couple that was so, so lovely. the guy who did his first transcontinental and asked his girlfriend to marry him on the spot. And that was so beautiful to see. You know, I think you might have seen that picture of this really, really dirty, filthy, lovely big guy just embracing his girlfriend and smelling all over the place. But it was so, so cute, and he was wearing that ring all race, and I only knew that afterwards. But it was so beautiful to see. So it's just raw emotions, basically, isn't it?
Yeah, it shows once again what these races move in paper.
Yeah,
I mean, one sometimes wonders why we do these crazy things or why people do them. And some people do them every year and others do them once. And yeah, but there is more behind it. And it's not just crazy, stupid.
That's why I find it so super interesting. And I mean, there are people that really don't get it. I mean, my husband, he loves the fact that I do crazy rides, but he's like, yeah, you do your thing. I don't see the fun in that. Yeah. And you know, people, there are a lot of people like that, and that's a good thing too, but it's like, it's really hard to explain, isn't it? Why that is fun or why that is valuable. It's just,
Do you see differences between the different types of races? I mean, you talked about the migration race and stage race, and it's going to be different. We know this already, but there's also a difference in length. For example, the Atlas Mountain race is done in under 4 days if you're fast. Do you see differences?
Maybe not in races per se as of yet, because I do feel that that might change in the future a little. But I think there are different competitors, basically, or participants, because you have people that really go in there to compete, and you have people that go in there to compete to them, well, kind of challenge themselves mainly as a goal. So I think you have people coming in for different reasons, and that will be the same for the migration, and that that is the same in the Transcontinental and the Atlas. You see people that are really challenging themselves, and there are people that want to compete to, you know, to really race and win something, or and they're of course also in there to challenge themselves, but in a different kind of state of mind. So I think maybe not as a, I mean, there is a strong community, of course, in the gravel races, and that really transfers to transcontinental and that kind of races as well, in that ultra endurance scene and community. But there are others coming in from different sides. You know, it can be from the fixed gear racing into endurance, like you know, and also it can be from pro scene, kind of really burned up by the whole pro riding and finding a way to enjoy cycling again, because that's what you definitely see happening as well. So that will be, I'm not sure of if that's different types of people specifically within these different races. I think it's more different types of people going in for different reasons, maybe. Yeah.
And now that you've been both at the Transcontinental race and at the Atlas Mountain race, and one rider, James McHayden, has participated in both.
Yeah.
And he's won the Transcontinental race several times. He came second in the second in the Atlas Mountain race. And now that you're kind of an expert on people after having done these races, is there a difference between a James McHayden who's done the Transcontinental race and one who's done the same James McHayden who's done the Atlas Mountain race?
Well, that's a fun question. I'm not an expert, by the way, in people finishing the races, but
I made you an expert.
No, but I am super interested in it, and it's also, I have been lucky enough to witness it up close for sure, for several races. Is there a difference? I don't know. I think James is definitely is, you know, he's one of a kind in itself. I think the way he can push and how he really invests in training and in racing, that's just a few people do it like he does, I feel. He grows as a person and what he can do. I think I liked the fact that the Atlas Mountain race, I was really, and we discussed that, I know him relatively well now because we spent some time in Greece after the Transcontinental, of course, and just, you know, bumped into each other more times, and I was really curious to see how he would do off-road, because he was really very much a road cyclist, but he really invested in that and learning the skills and really pushing that, and then again doing really well at the Atlas Mountain race, like you say, just coming in second, and that was more a lack of sleep from Sofiane then James not making his pace. So it was super interesting that to see where that it's, and we know that, but it's definitely not about who's the strongest cyclist. It's definitely also about, you know, the rest of the, how you manage time and sleep and food, etc. I don't know. I think he developed, but I don't know if that makes a difference as in how he came in. He just gives it all, always, I feel. And there are a couple, you know, more people that are in that field that give give it them all and just, you know, really dig very deep to not only finish, but finish well. And,
Yeah, I was wondering because, I mean, the transcontinental race is done in just under 8 days, if I...
Yeah, and it was depending. Under 9 days, I think it was that
under
time.
Nine,
maybe
true.
Now, maybe now under eight, yeah.
Could be. It always depends on the on the distance.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so... Oh, I can hear someone came home.
No, it's a cat, sorry.
Oh, it's a cat! It's a cat!
So
it's okay.
Just wait for him to stop. He's old and he doesn't hear well, so it's
he needs
to kind of make his
It's so funny
sometimes.
Because I once had a neighbor with three cats, and honestly, when they started fighting and screaming, it sounded like kids.
It's like he's getting worse at it, but he's now found his space in the sun, so I hope he's
okay. Yeah.
Sorry for that.
No, I just asked because I was wondering maybe someone needs you
or
something happens.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
He can take care of himself.
Yeah. Back to James Mark Hayden.
Yeah.
Okay. So we were talking about a race time of just under 9 days or between 8 and 9 days in a transcontinental race and around 4 days in an Atlas mountain race, for example.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, do things change because
the length of the race?
Does it change how people come in? I met James when I raced the transcontinental race, but since he was already there for a week, I guess, when he arrived.
Yeah.
I can't really tell you after anything about him directly after the race. I just wondered, since we have one strong racer who's done several races now, how if there's a difference.
It's interesting. Yeah, I think they not really as like I said, you on that level, going in there to compete, you give it your all, and then I think you kind of plan on the length it will take, you know. So you kind of try and he will manage his energy and everything differently than in a 4 day race. And for instance, Sofiane, for sure, because he said if it would have taken one extra day, then he wouldn't have made it because you can't keep on not sleeping, for instance. But I think so. I don't think there's. I think they manage the race as they go into it. You just kind of look ahead and say, okay, this is gonna take me 8, 9 or whatever your level or races or 14 days or whatever, or it's gonna take me 4 days, and I have to give my all in these 4 days. So it's kind of. I think it's more. It affects how you use your time and to rest, etc. as well. But
it is a different type of race.
Definitely.
Sofiane also says that this is his distance, so and his
strength. Yeah, that is his strength. Like I said, if it was 2 days longer, then in this case, very likely James would have won.
I believe so too. It would be interesting.
Yeah,
I haven't really seen. I can't recall Sofiane racing a longer race than that.
Maybe he did,
but I can't. He's always at the front, at least when it's like 3, 4 days.
Yeah,
maybe
definitely.
Five. Yeah, cool. Yeah, so there's another big project I would like to talk about, Shift Cycling Culture. And this is a very, I'm personally very interested in this too, because sustainability and changing the cycling industry, being more sustainable, has been a big topic on this podcast as well. Just recently I interviewed Alex from Porter Cycles, who's a frame builder from Germany. And we talked about fair production of cycles. And that it's really difficult, actually. We started looking into this, but yeah, there's much more to talk about, and maybe there aren't solutions for everything yet either. Yeah. But yeah, you started Shift Cycling Culture in 2018, and I heard about it because you organized these Klanker rides, you tell us what are they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's just a fun way to kind of engage people and let them think a little bit about their own consumer behavior and about how we kind of, I always say, how we treat what we own and how we kind of, you know, create waste or not, or etc. And it's the funny thing was that when I started with Shift, I came out of work-wise, out of working in a lot of projects that relate to creating a more sustainable food system. So it was very much about how the food system is right now is definitely not sustainable, but how that could be better, and how you can, you know, create more awareness and educate people, and also work more on the side of the government and the industries to make change. And I did that with a very nice, lovely international group of young people called Slow Food Youth Network. So I was very invested in this topic. And then I started cycling, because I didn't really start cycling as I do now until a year, I think 7 years ago or something. And then I came into cycling, and I realized that it wasn't at all a topic of conversation in cycling, not in media, not in the industry, but definitely also not in the cyclist I was riding with. And that kind of surprised me, because that, you know, there's a lot of, amongst my friends, you got a lot of educated and aware people. And then when I said, yeah, it's funny, because, you know, stuff that's been made in cycling, it's never been discussed if that's done with lower impact or I mean, cycling itself can be like a low impact, environmental impact activity, but bikes, etc., and all the stuff that we buy and make, and that's, it's funny, because it never really has been discussed. And then so many cyclists just were like, oh, I actually never thought of that, or never connected those dots. So that's one of the reasons to start Shift in the first place. But the Klunkers rides is like a fun way to kind of get people just realizing that, bringing it back to why we cycle. For the most people, even for people that are in more of a competitive cycling area, that it all started usually with the fact that it gives you freedom, and it gives you a way to explore, and it gives you a way to get into nature, and all those kind of things is why many of us ride in the first place. So the fact that you're so connected to those places and can explore on my bike, it doesn't really say much about why you need like the latest version or the perfect bike or the perfect kit. I mean, if you ride endurance races or ultra endurance races or etc., yeah, or you compete in those kind of things, of course it's good to have like a decent bike and a decent rain jacket and stuff like that. But like for the general cyclist or for the general rides that we do, what really do we need? You know, it's just two pedals and two wheels, or, and you know, you have a bike and you can just enjoy doing all those things. So Klunkers rides are really to bring people back to the love for cycling and not the stuff that comes with it or belongs to it. So and the good thing is that you can, you know, it always was like a do-it-yourself event. Also in 2018, I just threw it out there and people could just join in locally and do it on a specific date. So it kind of combines everyone's efforts and you can look at everyone else doing the same thing in a different region or a different country, or, and just making it your own. Just, you know, some did coffee outside in Berlin, or some did an overnighter this year as well, or some just make it like a thing to get more people on a bike in general for commuting even, or it just, that's a good thing about it. You can just make it your own and do whatever you like to do, as long as you kind of make the theme that it's just bring a bike that you maybe usually wouldn't use if you have one, or just try and kind of get into the mindset of how do I buy and how do I, you know, change up stuff and how much do I buy, and kind of that kind of awareness is what it's all about, really.
As far as I understand, Shift Cycling Culture is about the community and raising awareness within the community through gear swap parties, cleanup rides, and these clunker rides that we just talked about. But it's also about talking to the industry and the brands. And I saw that there are articles and interviews on your website. But what else do you do? Like, do you discuss with them better ways of production, or how can you influence the industry as a non-profit organization?
Yeah, it's lovely, because I really specifically wanted to, when I started it, we're now a team of three, but when I started, I really wanted to both, focus on the industry as the community, because that's like two-way street, that both, you need changes and you need kind of sort of the push from consumers saying they want change, and also the industry itself that needs to change. So that was always the idea, but actually recently, like since last November, we hosted the first industry meetup. I was doing the interviews that you just mentioned before I started that. It's called 5 Questions 4, and just to show that there are the brands that are trying to take steps and make changes, to just give a very open and honest account of the challenges that come with it, because it's definitely not easy, specifically not in a competitive market, but in general, like you said before, it's some changes are just not possible yet for different reasons. So I want them to give an honest account of where they were at and what they faced and what the challenges were, etc. There's not too many not too many brands really, really already moving in that space. I mean, right now, yes, but definitely not when I started in 2018. So what always intended to do was to kind of see how we could, and that might be like a very ambitious, ambitious dream and goal, but think big and, you know, that might help to change something, is to kind of start with meetups to at least get that conversation going. Because like I said, I was so surprised that in cycling it wasn't really discussed. And I thought, if you can kind of get industry together and at least kind of talk about this topic and just open it up and kind of invite media to think and talk about it, etc., that will, public opinion will change in the end on how brands will react. I mean, that's just a fact. So we started, I initially wanted to do like a live meetup, but then Corona happened, of course. It was in the books for like 2 years already, but like the real live meetup we planned for April last year. So that was just around the time that everything, was going off. and so then we decided to make that a virtual meetup, which we did in November. And that was quite amazing, actually, because to answer your question, can we change something as a non-profit, non-funded group of enthusiasts? Because that's basically what it is. I actually feel that we indeed have a role in that, because bringing those people together, and in that first initial meetup, we had around 100 people signing up for that, coming from any kind of brand that you can imagine from cycling, like the bigger ones, the smaller ones, some just frame builders on an individual level. It was anyone and everyone just could join and also did join, and that was pretty amazing to see, because you see this whole group of people that is really willing to make changes, but usually just either don't know how, don't know where to start, feel that they started too late, because in other industries it's already like, you know, there's a lot of greenwashing going on, but still the conversation is going. Wants to change, but their CEO doesn't want to change, or it could be anything. But I mean, at least there is a group of willing and people working in the cycling industry and often cyclists themselves who do feel they want that change. So that in itself was really beautiful to see. What we did after that was really regroup and say, okay, how can we kind of facilitate this change as good as we can? Because, I mean, we're not the brands and we're not able to, you know, make any statements on how to change. We can only kind of facilitate. So from then on, we started both doing more specific meetups, which for instance, and then flying in someone from outside that knows what they're talking about and can really answer questions and really help things forward. And for instance, we had head of sustainability and material, well, head of materials and innovation, I have to say, from Patagonia International, who was willing to do one of those chats and really explained the why of the importance, but also what kind of challenges they face and how they dealt with it and how what kind of innovations were maybe interesting in cycling industry, etc. And all these kind of meetups are really well attended and help to at least start conversations within the companies, and that's the first step. And we now also do, because that needs to be discussed on different levels, we also have a group of CEOs of some of the bigger companies within cycling who kind of meet up now, and we facilitate that meetup with a speaker, and they discuss this subject as well. And it's just really, I love to see the kind of sometimes the humbleness of just saying, look, we're just at the beginning of this journey. In some cases, they're a little bit further ahead, but it's just the willingness is there. And I mean, there's of course also sometimes it's just marketing talk, and sometimes it's just speaking but not doing. But in a lot of cases, I find there is a willingness, and if we can facilitate, you know, giving the information, bringing brands together, etc., that will really help change. I mean, we're not changing it, but we can play a role in it for sure, because we're like an objective, independent little platform that kind of brings people together and opens up discussion. And I think that's super valuable.
So what do you think? Where can the cycling culture be shifted to?
Well, if to keep it to the industry for now, is that there is a lot to win in reducing impact in production and distribution. I mean, you know, the very low hanging fruit is packaging that we still, if we receive stuff that's still usually like wrapped in plastic like crazy, or, you know, stuff like that is low hanging but super important. But very much also from, you know, raw materials that they get from suppliers that might be coming produced in ways, like, let me say that, produced in ways that it can be way more sustainable, lesser of a footprint. That kind of stuff is super important. And to give one more example, what we do now is have this project that's going to be like a experimental pilot, basically, on one item that is not really in a competitive space for a lot of brands, but is being used by a lot of brands, and that's a zipper. And zippers are used in bags and in jerseys, of course, and there are a lot of brands that kind of want to see how they can kind of connect to the supplier, which is in many cases the same one. But standing by themselves, they can't change anything. And now we're looking into how we can bring these brands together to kind of collectively work on that. So that is the production side of things. And I think for cyclists, it's two-sided as well. It's just our own personal impact is, of course, still very much important. It's how you, not only as a cyclist, how you kind of, you know, look at your consumer behavior, or how do you, I don't know, even stuff like buying or using bars in plastic wrappers or whatever you can do to kind of reduce that impact is good. But also on just a human level, you know, we're all people that we can kind of look into how we mortgage our house, or because that's usually quite the sum of money, and that has an impact, or how we can reduce our meat. And I know that you definitely will agree with that, but eating of meat, because that's like on a personal level, that's actually one of, I think it, today, The Guardian, there was a piece on that research that it's the single one biggest impact on the environment is eating meat. And I know that because I come from the food, you know, food related projects. I know that for a longer time, but it's like, it's one of the things that you can, and you don't have to cut it all away if you want, but if you, even if you just consciously decide to eat less or use less, or, you know, it's all these kind of things, real, they will matter. That said, it's just, of course, very much about creating a different system overall that will help, shift things really. But I do believe, and that's why I think, you know, talking to the cycling community, I mean, like I said, we're all humans and we're cyclists, and we kind of find the same passion in this. And that also means that we're kind of a community that has a strong voice, specifically as we're also really connected to the outdoors. And I think if we can really come together and use that voice, first of all, of course, directed to our own industry and our own behavior, but also as a voice just to say, look, this is important, and this, it is actually just an existential threat, really, you know. So it's something that we really should be kind of worrying about, I think, and advocating for on that level, both individually as a community.
Yeah. Before we coming to another, it's not another product. It's a film you're planning to make. Just one last question concerning this sustainability in cycling industry. I already mentioned that Alex from Porter Cycles was here, and he's a fan of steel bikes, and he's a fan of steel because it's the most sustainable material that you can use for building bikes. After the podcast, I was like, okay, I can't really buy carbon bikes anymore, but a lot of brands only build carbon bikes. So is it too radical to say that there must be a real shift to other materials?
Yeah, I personally definitely agree, because carbon is not only very much landfill product. You can't repair it now slightly, and they start developing ways to recycle it, but that's still not on the same level as the original product. Whilst aluminium is a little bit better, but that's also not like 100% replaceable. But the same thing for steel. I actually have a steel bike myself, and what I love about it is the fact that it's both completely recyclable, because you can use it again and again if you want, if at least it's you know, collected in the right way and recycled in the right way, but at least the material in itself can be reused for the same purposes. But also because in that way, it's something that is more timeless. I think carbon is very much a fashion item usually, because they kind of mold it into all these different kind of versions that it's, it feels old school even after 2 years, basically. And that's ridiculous. And it's also, I don't know too much about it as in the production process, but I know from someone who does research on it, it's also a very wasteful material. So if you cut it to make, for instance, to make a bike, you have to throw away a lot of it that you can't use in other ways. So I definitely think that that's where it should be going. And I do believe that innovation can bring part of the solution, because you can look into ways in the future maybe where carbon can be recycled in a really good way, or you get other materials that can kind of replace that same those same characteristics, because steel is of course a bit of a different material. But it is definitely, if you talk waste, the carbon is definitely one of the things. I think, to be honest, also apparel, because people use that a lot and kind of replace that a lot, but there's bigger steps to be made there because there's already way more knowledge. And for carbon, it's still kind of at the beginning of how to deal with this, but there's definitely landfill of carbon bikes. And yeah, like I said, it's also something that people easily seem to want to replace. Yeah, so I totally agree with you. And I think, I mean, that stuff, I'm very much about collaborating, because I feel, as a person, it's just how, you know, I look at things and am. But I also feel that it's easier to kind of change things. There's a place for everything. So you need people that really kind of go against the grain, but you also need collaboration to kind of move forward. And we are really trying to bring the community, the industry together in this kind of thing. But this stuff is definitely what we discuss as well. It's like, it's one of the things that is definitely, impacting. And also my feeling is not necessary, because you have other options, and you have steel bikes, and you have, even aluminium that is already better, like I said. So it's, yeah, I for me, it's really hard. And that goes for a lot of these issues. If we know it's harmful, and if we have alternatives, why are we still doing the wrong thing? I know it's sometimes complicated, and I know that there's a whole market for it, of people that just want, you know, fast looking bikes or whatever it might be.
Yeah. But fast and light. And
but still, I can, you know, I mean, still, yeah. like I said, I have a steel bike, and I do complain sometimes that it's riding up steep hills, that it has a few grams more, but it's also the setup for the rest of, you know, the wheels that I use or whatever, and it's also just being stronger is way cheaper. Becoming stronger is way cheaper, or losing weight. First, in some cases, I don't feel like I have to, but in some cases, it's like, you see these old guys, very stereotyped that I say that now, but these old guys with big bellies, and they're on this very light carbon bike, and you're like, you could also just, I don't know, cycle a little bit more, and then you will just lose those those 500 grams, and then you can buy a steel bike. But it's hard to kind of, you know, tell people what to buy and that they're not allowed to if it's on the market. I think in that case, yeah, that's why I also very much feel that we need the industry to change as well, because demand will help, but it's also just what is being offered. You know, if we all would do steel bikes, you know, if for instance, also in the pro cycling, where grams do count, if everyone's on a steel bike, then it's a fair, even playing ground again, right?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah, like simple. You said, go to any bike, any normal bike shop. I mean, there's always others, but go to a normal bike shop. There won't be steel bikes, competitive steel bikes.
And the weird thing is, that's only 2 decades, I think, you know?
Yeah.
So that's one of the things that keeps me up in a positive way, keeps me motivated, is in general change. When you talk about climate change, it's something that is really overwhelming as an issue, you know? It's like, how can I really contribute to this as an individual, or in itself as a problem? It's so huge. But if I look back, and it's something I just love doing in a way, because if you look back at history, it's only like 3 generations when there was this massive change that changed the world in the Industrial Revolution, or the digital revolution that even happened in my lifetime, where you feel change doesn't need more than 1 generation, really, does it? So why can't we just speed it up a little and just, you know, change the system in that sense, that it's not really using our planetary resources as if it's endless, because it's not. It's not endless. And we just have to find another way to work with that. And there is another way. So I just don't, it's really hard for me to grasp that people just keep on kind of pushing that ahead. Well, it's obvious enough that things need to change. But like I said, it also makes me kind of optimistic because I feel we can do big changes, or we can make big changes in just one generation. So yeah, and the same goes if you bring it down to cycling. Why not just say, look, pro cycling needs to ride steel bikes, and then for sure the your shop next door will have steel bikes again. It's just that simple. Well, it's not that simple.
we rode steel bikes at the Retro Crit. I know that there was I rode a Quirk, and my very first retro bike was also steel.
Ah, beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was this this awareness was already there. And Rob Quirk built our bikes when
beautiful
I was
bikes.
I have it hanging here.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Right now it's hanging on the wall, but maybe I have to ride more fixed again soon.
But it could also be a movement in the sense that I feel like, you know, that's what I mean with we are a community that is, of course, like way bigger if you count commuters, etc. But like as a things just start from small groups anyways, change starts from small groups anyway, usually. And if you just at one point would say, look, we're just, you know, going to do steel bikes and that's it. And that's our game. And that will kind of, it will set an example that, and that goes for if you do that in different areas, or if you kind of at least discuss stuff like that and start asking questions about it. And that's what I feel with Shift we're trying to do, and just throw things out there and kind of try to inspire brands and cyclists to kind of, you know, buy differently and offer differently. That already will help. Yeah.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about shifting the cycling culture, and now finally we're coming to your big project, your very recent project, a film about climate change, looking at it from the perspective of the cycling scene, from cycling. And yeah, I've seen the trailer and really loved it. You're planning to produce a film called Cracked Earth, and yes, now I'll give you the word to explain to us what this is going to be about.
Cool. Yeah. One of the things that also is now part of Shift is I felt I wanted to make this film because there is still, I'll just say what it's about first, and that's that it's indeed following cyclists all over the world living in vulnerable areas where climate change is actually already a daily reality and not something of the future, because that's still what I find speaking to a lot of people. It even if people are aware, they're not, still a lot of people don't really feel it. I mean, in my direct bubble, yes, everyone kind of agrees, but there's a whole world out there of people that don't really feel the urgency. They know things are changing, and so of course, like, I don't know, the majority now really does worry about climate change or kind of is aware of climate change, but the fact that it's already happening right now is something that a lot of people don't really feel yet. So what the film is about is like looking into cycling communities all over the world that are in those kind of vulnerable areas, and one of them is South Australia, which is of course a very obvious one with all the bushfires and the heat and the drought, and that really is diving more into the pro kind of cycling for one part, a link to the Tour Down Under where we were able to film and interview and also interview a pro cyclist from EF, Mitch Docker, EF Education, and then also connect with the community, a lovely community around Curve Cycling, who's in Melbourne, who are in Melbourne, I have to say, and they are of course more adventure cyclists, let me say that, kind of gravel cyclists as more in the line of how I ride, etc. But that was a very obvious one, and we were there just after the extreme bushfires even for that area last year, so that was pretty intense. The second location is the Swiss Alps, where we follow Caro and Anita Gehrig, two lovely
girls, twins, who race enduro mountain bike on a pro level. And the Alps are very vulnerable for the temperatures rising, and not only just the snow lines receding, but for that reason also having more extreme weather and more landslides and rockfall, etc. And then the third one is actually through COVID, because we couldn't travel to the third location, but that is kind of a blessing in itself, because the Netherlands is definitely dealing with climate change issues, and not just because we're a low-lying coastal area. I mean, everyone knows that we're below sea level, which in itself is already, you know, kind of a threat. But we've been able to work ourselves out of that issue for decades and centuries now. But we actually do deal with things like drought and drinking water issues. And we're very much an agricultural nation. And that's, you know, there's a lot of pressure on farmers for the lack of rain, or the extreme weather, or it's just changing and affecting so much more than just the fact that, you know, sea level was rising and we need to build higher dikes. It's way more complex, and I find it very interesting to kind of try and show to the audience that it's something that us in this generation, you know, is affecting us, and is affecting us as cyclists, but also just as humans and you know, individuals living in different areas of the world that are similar. I hope to kind of wake up a larger group of people to kind of really feel that it is really an urgent and pressing issue that affects us all, and it's not just something that is, you know, happening in 20 or 50 years from now, because it's not anymore. And yes, part of the people will know, but still then, I think some of the stories I heard filming this film were shocking to me as well, you know. And I, even from a Netherlands point of view, I live here, and some of the things that I learned through making this film kind of really woke me up as how far these issues already are going. And so that's gonna, I really hope we can kind of make more people aware, engage more people in what we're trying to do with Shift and in climate action in general. So that's what the film is about. And as you say, we are crowdfunding at the moment because Shift is a non-funded initiative. Like I just said, we're now an official foundation, but it's all just three people working really hard with some hands here and there to help us out. And we do that with love, but it's just also it's a lot of work and it's a lot of effort. It would be amazing if people can help us with a few projects, and one of them is definitely this film.
And how can they help? Like, do you have different packages?
We run a Kickstarter campaign. You can find it on via Kickstarter, Cracked Earth Film. And there are rewards on there as well. So it's not just donating, but there's some good stuff, I feel, in there to get in return, which is a couple of beautiful prints from my friend Jelle Mill, who's a photographer and illustrator, Natasha Lopes, and some other things that are part of it. And of course, just being the one that can kind of see it first in an online premiere, stuff like that. But we did find that, unfortunately, Kickstarter only offers credit card, and that's just not obvious, an obvious, you know, payment means for a lot of people, including myself, actually. So we have now opened up a link with several other options, and that's just on our website. So it's just shiftcycling.com/ Correct Earth crowdfunding.
Okay, I'll link everything in the episode description as well.
Yeah.
Nice. I was of course, I had a look at the packages and I really liked that there's one option where you buy the right to print one of these nice illustrations on your own used shirt.
Yeah.
I thought that really cool.
Yeah, that was because I felt really, it doesn't feel right to kind of be pushing a lot of product while I'm very much, you know, about creating awareness, or we as Shift are creating awareness in you know, how we produce and consume. So I felt that it was a good way of still offering that option, but also in a fun way saying, you know, just get this t-shirt out of your closet that's kind of boring and you're not wearing anymore for that reason, and kind of print that on that t-shirt, or so to give that a bit of a different kind of angle to it. So yeah, I really hope people will do it, because that would be so cool to see as well afterwards. Seeing some of the t-shirts that will hopefully pop up with that print on it.
Yeah, yeah, very smart, because I feel you there. It's always like, people are selling things to support something else, but
yeah,
you don't want to buy stuff if you don't really need it. And yeah, so a very smart option.
Cool. Yeah, and like I said, it's also, or what is on there, it's also, you know, you can also use it to hang on the wall. So it's also even giving more options in that sense. You can also use that print to kind of frame it, or yeah. So that's, yeah, good that you like it.
Yeah, super cool. Well, Leanne, it was amazing to talk to you.
Thank you.
I think we've covered quite a few topics today.
Definitely.
And probably not all, because you've done a lot in these 8 years of cycling. And of course, you're doing also other photography, and I will link your blog and your personal website and everything, and also the article about the Transcontinental Race that I really liked. And yeah, so if anyone is interested, you can follow you. What's your Instagram? Is it Salt Lake?
Salt Lake_Leanne.
Yeah. So why Salt Lake?
That's funny. That's a whole story in itself, but to give a very, very brief version is that I just, when I started as a freelancer, I didn't want my full name because it's kind of boring. And I just read this book and I did a beautiful trip that kind of related to taking the less beaten paths. And yeah, it's a long story why, but anyway, that's why that reminded me of a trip that I did through South America, where I ended up on a route that was far from the tourist route on a salt lake. And so I was like, oh, I'm Salt Lake Productions. And then starting Instagram, I didn't even cycle by then. But that became kind of the name. And then now it's a bit confusing sometimes because people think I'm in Salt Lake City. And it's also something that is now, you know, some of my cycling friends just call me Salt Lake on the bike, which is kind of, yeah, it's funny. I like it, but it's just, it's stuck, and I'm not going to, you know, not going to change it, but, it has a reference that is really, has a lot to do about how I look at things. So, yeah, it has a good reference for me.
Yeah. Fits. And in the end, I always ask two questions. One is, who as a person inspires you?
Ooh, I actually know that question from other podcasts I listened to from your podcast, but I totally didn't think of that myself. It's tough because I've never had like a not even as a teenager, I didn't have any posters on the wall of people that I really. It's more, I really admire people who for some trades that they have, or some. Yeah, you know, people that are really following their own path or are just very honest not very straightforward in how they proceed with things, and that's like a very, that's, that can be like people around you that are really close that you can kind of admire, or in the cycling industry as well. I think, yeah, it's a hard one to name one. Let me think about that a little.
Yeah, some have named more than one and said, yeah, this one, this is a trait I like.
Yeah.
That person. Yeah.
Yeah, I like things that I like. Yeah, well, let me see. Can I answer that? It's a hard one.
Really, we can put the book question first. Do you have a? Yeah. Do you read? And if
I
so,
I read a lot. Yes.
Ah, cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, this is also a book recommendation podcast.
Cool.
Secretly. So, do you have a book that you would like to recommend?
I actually do have a book that is not cycling related, but is climate related. But the thing is, I have to look up the English title quickly because it's really, really a lovely way of talking about the climate change and everything that's happening in a very understandable way and also very in your face way. The English version of the title is How Are We Going to Explain This? Our Future on an Ever Warming Planet. And it's by Jelmer Mommers, a young Dutch guy who's linked to a journalism platform. Very knowledgeable guy, but it's just the way he puts things really underlines the urgency, but on a very, like I said, low threshold way. It's very, very easy, accessible, and very well written. But it's just, it's so... Yeah, it's so good to grasp where we're at and how we should evolve from here, and it's also just a really good read. So it is about this subject, but it's also just, yeah, underlying the urgency of how can we, and I think you might be able to relate as a parent as well, how can we explain this to our kids later if we, you know, if we don't take action now with all the knowledge that we have. You should be able to just look your kid in the eye, and that's definitely one of my motivations, and later and say, at least I, you know, I try to do my best, even if it's just a small part. So yeah, I'll send you the link, but it's definitely worth a read. Yeah, that's definitely one good one.
Sounds really good. Yeah. Cool.
And it's on topic because I love to read like a lot of, you know, adventure stories and just fiction as well. But it's like reading is a really good way to order your thoughts, I feel, and kind of get other perspectives. But this is on topic, so yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah. I'll make sure it's linked in the episode description. Yeah. And have you found an inspiring person?
Yeah, it's still a hard one, but for the things I am doing right now, I could definitely say someone like Michael de Lagrange that I mentioned before for the Migration Gravel Race, because I feel he is such a, his drive comes from such an authentic, although I hate the word, but authentic place, and he's he's someone that really uses all his both professional as personal knowledge and experience, etc., to kind of do work for others. And I really admire that, and I admire him for that. So yeah, that's definitely someone that I admire for sure. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Human rights lawyer, yes, by profession.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if we mentioned this before. Yeah. Leon, thanks so much. This has been, I learned a lot, and all these topics are very close to my heart as well. And yeah, so
thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it. And yeah, great to be able to share some things about Shift and also the other projects.
Yeah. We have to talk about that maybe afterwards.
Cool.
I mean, as a podcaster, I can, of course, I always ask myself what I can do, besides, you know, raising these topics in the
which
podcast.
Which is a really good one. Yeah. Yeah. Would love to discuss anything, any ideas or, Because I really believe in bringing that all together and kind of, bringing efforts together. And it's just the way to go.
Same here. But for now, have a great rest of the day. Thanks for your time. And maybe see you at some of these races in the future
Let's
when,
hope so. Let's hope so. It would be
cool.
amazing. Yeah, thank you
Well,
so much,
thank
Bona.
you.
Really enjoyed
Bye.
it. Thank you. Bye.
Bye. What a great person. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. And as always, let me know what you think. Give me some feedback. Give me a nice comment on Apple Podcasts. That really helps the podcast to get visibility. And for those who don't know yet, there is a Komoot podcast profile where I collect nice roots from my guests. And we also have a new collection from Leon van Leeuwen there. So check it out. And I reorganized our two community collections, the HörerInnen collections, and there's now a separate one for road and one for mountain bike and gravel, because there were just too many beautiful routes, and I thought it was a good idea to separate these two. Check them out, they're beautiful routes from all over Germany and beyond, Austria and Switzerland and wherever the podcast listeners live. So if you want to add one, share one of your favorite tracks with the community, go for it. How this works is all on the Komoot profile, and you can just follow the instructions there. So far, that's it. I'm still celebrating the 50th episode, and see you in 2 weeks. And I can tell you there will be a German episode. And no, I forgot, there will be a special Orbit episode before that. So make sure you subscribe to Die wundersame Fahrradwelt, because otherwise you might miss out on the extra episode.